Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey.
Hey, Tenderfoot listeners, Dennis Cooper here. If you're a fan of Culpable, then you know we normally focus on one case for an entire season, like the season one case of Christian Andreacchio and the season two case of Brittany Stikes. As I continue working on season three, I'll be using this platform to help more families in their fight for justice. Last fall, I brought you 6 cases over 6 weeks. Now, I'm bringing you 5 more. From Tenderfoot TV, another installment of Culpable Case Review is available now. Check out this clip.
So she jumped over her friend into the driver's seat, hit the gas. Her foot did not let off the gas. She hit a mailbox. I think she rolled into a tree, and she was already dead.
From Tenderfoot TV, Culpable Case Review is available now. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts or subscribe to Tenderfoot Plus for early access and ad-free listening. Learn more at tenderfootplus.com.
Last episode, journalist Kevin Fagan worked with Jackie Horn to find her sister, a deadhead who left Vermont for San Francisco. Bridget Pendle Williamson ended up homeless, addicted to drugs, and last spoke with her family in 1996. I found Jackie's old website on archive.org. One of the pages said investigative efforts. She writes, "In January 2004, I heard about an article published in the San Francisco Chronicle about homelessness in the San Francisco area. This 5-part series followed several San Francisco residents through their personal struggles as members of the homeless community. Kevin Fagan's article provided a premise by which to experience the sad existence of these individuals and their struggle to survive. Further, the photographic images captured the human element of a problem so appalling to the general public that they typically cringe at the sight. In no time, I contacted Kevin and Brant in hopes that one of the many homeless that they had come in contact with was my sister. After a few telephone conversations, Kevin suggested that my search for Bridget would make a good story. I arrived in San Francisco a few weeks later. I was accompanied by Debbie Hartman, Kevin Fagan, and Brant Ward. Our first meeting began with a roundtable discussion of what we knew. We combed through the few things of Bridget's I had, in hopes of finding some new clue that may bring us a few steps closer to finding her. Within a few hours, the four of us hit the streets of San Francisco. We began by visiting places we knew Bridget had been and talked to people who may have known her. We were able to find many people who shared information with us about my sister. Some of the information was older, but still helpful in the sense that we knew she had been in the city within the past 5 years. There is a fact that I must share in order to give you an idea of how receiving the homeless were of me. Not one homeless person attempted to hustle me. I wasn't solicited for money or even a single cigarette. Every person we spoke with stopped everything they were doing and gave me, Kevin, Debbie, and Brant their undivided attention. In some odd way, the attitudes and atmosphere not only gave me insight into homelessness, but more importantly, I felt comforted by the fact that my sister is or once was a member of a caring and relatively close-knit community.
I walked the streets with her in San Francisco with Kevin Fagan and his photographer, Brant Ward. And Kevin knew the ins and outs of that area because of his incredible piece on homelessness in San Francisco. And he took us into crazy little places in wooded areas that we never would have gone to on our own. And we walked together while she was handing out flyers.
I spoke with Debbie Hartman, Deputy Public Administrator for Santa Cruz.
She was also looking for her sister, so when you have that drive, it really, you can find so much more information, I think, sometimes when you have that certain drive, even more than people who have these fancy databases and government things at their fingertips. There's just something about it when it's inside you. She called San Francisco and was trying to make a missing persons report. And they said no, because Bridget was over 18. She was an adult. She could do what she wanted to do. So they wouldn't take the missing person report. And I understand what their detectives were saying. I don't know if she called sheriff, if she called the police department or who there, but they went by that she was an adult. So technically they weren't considering her missing. She called Santa Cruz. I don't know if she knew Bridget was here once in a while or had been here at one time, but she put a shot out to see if that would work. And our coroners take the missing persons report. They received it and realized that they were mandated to take this report within 4 hours, and they did. So they asked me if I wanted to handle it. I'm like, yes, please. I would love to take a look at that. And that's how I came to know Bridget. She was a mom, she was a sister, she was a daughter. Maybe she made some bad options in her life, but certainly doesn't deserve to just be forgotten and tossed away.
My name is Karen Sinanu Towery. I led up the homicide unit there in Santa Clara County for a number of years and started a cold case unit. I think from the history of man, prostitutes have been targeted. It's a little different now because there's not as much street prostitution. The internet changed that business model. A lot of people make their connections online, and women are not in as much danger as they were when they were walking the streets. They still, you know, prostitutes still will do a meetup through the internet, and they will be abused or ultimately killed by someone, but the street prostitutes have always had it bad. You'll read stories about communities where the police department put that way down on their list of priorities, and those women are forgotten. The case I just worked on for the last 8 years and got my client out and found factually innocent, there was a connected murder case. It's out of Sacramento. And my investigator and I, he was a retired San Jose deputy chief, we both worked really hard on this innocence case and had went up to the California Supreme Court, had hearings in Sacramento, and we solved a related homicide of a woman who was a street woman. And Sacramento's done nothing. They had all the leads back in 98. We handed them more information on a silver platter. They did nothing. They've done nothing. And I know that because during our evidentiary hearing on my case, the judge allowed me to go into the sheriff's file. And there was a note saying, oh, the Innocence Project says they have information. That someone just took the note and put it in the file and did nothing. And a lot of agencies are like this. It's like, oh, well, they just don't give priority to prostitutes. You know, there's nothing. There's no one in their corner. There's no one calling saying, are you going to solve my daughter's murder? You know, it's really heartbreaking. Really hard. They become non-people, these women. Part of it is the instinct of people. These are people that the community at large, like, they go, oh, I wish we didn't have prostitution. I wish we didn't have homeless. So when one person in that population disappears, they don't care that much.
Yeah, you could have somebody with a badge and a gun who's done this the whole time, and their father did this, and their father before them did this, and yay for you, that's really true. But sometimes these folks who come out here and just look at this, and it's just a different way of processing that information, and that way of processing the information might give a good lead. it's not an insult to anybody who's working hard on it. It's just somebody looking at it and saying, well, hey, you know, this might be a way to link up or find an answer.
It's very much like death row. You look at a death row in any state, it's not that they're people of color that's so amazing. It's that the victims are white people. The overwhelming number of victims, of perpetrators on death row, are white people. And that's because the communities care about their white people. It's really shocking. It's reflective of what the community, the issues the community cares about. And they care about homelessness and prostitution and drug use. They care about it because they want it to disappear. So when one of the population disappears, they don't get exercised over it. The community doesn't. And when the community doesn't, oftentimes law enforcement reflects that. It's a bias that most people wouldn't admit. I'm an old Caucasian lady, and I've seen this bias my entire career. It's just there. Hopefully we'll get away from it, but it's there.
Jackie asked Brant if she could see all of his photos from the series, Shame of the City. And she saw the picture of the crier who was lying on the sidewalk in a sleeping bag or with blankets on her. And Jackie thought that that person looked a lot like Bridget.
Here's Debbie Hartman again, the deputy public administrator who helped Jackie Horn, Bridget's sister.
The people were very receptive to her. And in fact, she came across Cosmic Charlie, I think was a neighbor or a friend of Bridget's, just somewhere down in the Haight. He went by Cosmic Charlie Aldo. He maybe was in his 40s. He was receptive and talkative, and he was going to show us something and open his backpack, and then decided to change his mind and didn't do that. And people wanted to help. I think they volunteered information if they thought they knew or if they didn't know or thought we wanted to hear, but it was out there, and she tried really hard. And after the article was in the paper, I remember my phone was just jammed with people who had seen that, and they had thought they'd seen her, or they were missing a relative for quite some time. Would I be able to help them find the relatives? It was incredible the number of people that read it and responded. It'll always be alive until we find otherwise. It's more than likely, but I'm not going to say I think she's deceased. Just no proof of it yet.
Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country, the kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Another page from Jackie's website was titled Details of Disappearance. She She said, on December 24th of 1996, Bridget Pendle Williamson moved to San Francisco, California with a male friend. They moved into a rent-by-week hotel. Her family never saw or heard from her again. We are certain that by the late 1990s, Bridget was addicted to both heroin and cocaine. She was last known to have been using between 20 and 30 bags of heroin and 2 to 3 grams of cocaine intravenously per day. She had been on methadone in the past, and maybe again. Through investigation, we've learned that Bridget spent many nights homeless on the streets of the Tenderloin and Mission areas of San Francisco, and may have stayed at the following hotels. She then lists 4 rent-by-week hotels. Information obtained through investigation suggests that Bridget was last known to have been working as a prostitute in the area of 16th and 19th off of Cap Street in San Francisco. Her distinguishing characters are listed as a yellow rose tattoo on her upper thigh, light blue cat tattoo wearing a pearl necklace on her lower abdomen, tribal tattoo on her right bicep, and a 1.5 to 2 inch bilateral scar on her inner elbow region. She wrote, beginning in the early 1990s, Bridget began following the Grateful Dead rock band and continued to do so for several years. This has been a defining piece of our search for her.
I guess we ought to thank you a lot for coming on out here today. Hope it's been a lot of fun. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bill Graham. From Marin County, California, to Watkins Glen, in New York, here we go, the Grateful Dead.
At the age of 15, Mitchell Weiser bought 2 tickets to Summer Jam and planned to take his friend Larry to see the Grateful Dead. Larry's mom did not approve, so Mitchell asked his girlfriend, and she said yes. When Mitchell ran his plans by his mom, she didn't approve either. She argued with him, and when she realized she couldn't stop him, she tried to give him money, but he refused and brushed past her, heading out the door. Mitchell's girlfriend, Bonita Bickwit, worked at a summer camp in New York. She asked for the night off to see the concert, but her boss said no. So at the age of 16, she decided to quit her job, collect her last check, and head to the show anyways. Mitchell took a cab to the camp Bonita worked at and spent most of the $25 he brought to get there. He called his sister to let her know that he made it there safe, but he was almost out of money. His sister tried to get him to come back home. He decided to head out anyways. He was determined to see the Dead. They planned on hitchhiking there. The camp worker who drove them to Narrowsburg said they were standing on the side of the road trying to hitch another ride when he drove away. They were never seen again.
Bonita Bonnie Bickwit and Mitch Weiser were not alone. There were others just like them, standing along State Route 97 with nothing but backpacks, sleeping bags, cardboard signs, and tickets for that weekend's show. Some, like Bonnie and Mitch, were only 15, 16 years old. Many had defied their parents, maybe even pushed past an overprotective older sister. And they walked right out that door after they'd just been warned to not walk out that door. Before that, they're asked the standard questions. Questions like, what the hell was in Watkins Glen that you couldn't get in Brooklyn? Honestly, they didn't know all that much about Watkins Glen. It was Nowheresville. They knew it had a racetrack, the Grand Prix Raceway it was called. And they knew this because that coming Saturday, July 28th, 1973, the racetrack was the site of Summer Jam, an all-day, all-night concert featuring the Grateful Dead, the Allman Brothers Band, and the band. And nothing was going to stop them from going. Though their overprotective sisters didn't want to admit it, they'd done the exact same thing just 4 years earlier, due east in a little town called Woodstock. Okay, technically it was a little town near Woodstock, but same difference. Bonnie and Mitch were lucky enough to get a lift for part of the way, but they still had 75 more miles to go. Every time they held up their big piece of cardboard, the one with Watkins Glen written on it with a ballpoint pen, it felt like their efforts were in vain. At least they had each other. Some made it to Watkins Glen that weekend, others did not. The truly unlucky ones found themselves trapped somewhere between here and there, in purgatory, which, on Friday, July 27th, the day before the big show, happened to be a two-lane blacktop that led into town. Traffic was stalled for miles. Cars were abandoned. Hippies trudged on in bare feet. The sun beat down on all that steel idling on asphalt. And the weatherman said it was going to be close to 90 degrees that day, but damn if it didn't feel even hotter. Those who stayed in their cars could pick up the faint signal of the station CFR on their AM or FM dial. CFR stood for Concert Free Radio, a Hartford pirate radio station masquerading as a Canadian outfit that broadcasts live traffic and safety reports directly from an RV parked at the Grand Prix Raceway. The CFR station was how everyone in Purgatory on that Friday afternoon heard that the highway had officially been shut down. Jim Koplik, one of the festival's promoters, got the same message, but he heard it directly from the New York State Thruway Authority. That was a phone call he wasn't expecting. Jim panicked. If the highway was shut down, if people couldn't get to Watkins Glen, he was going to have to refund tickets. He and his co-promoter, Shelley Finkel, would lose their shirts. Jim's second show promoting the Grateful Dead would also be his last. The Dead would never work with him again. They'd already tried to kill him. Well, not the Dead themselves, but Big Steve Parrish, one of their roadies. All Jim did was walk onto the stage and try to introduce himself. Parrish wasn't in a making new friends kind of mood. Besides, he'd already met the promoter, and it wasn't Jim Koplik. Jim tried to explain that he was co-promoting the show with Shelley Finkel, but by that point, Parrish had grabbed him and picked him up and was now tossing Jim's body like a half-eaten cheese sandwich on Shakedown Street. Luckily, Jim Koplik didn't have to suffer the humiliation of being dropped 14 feet onto the ground by a roadie in front of a massive audience. By the time the audience got there, Jim had bigger problems on his hands than a pissed-off Steve Parrish. Jim and Shelley knew the show was going to be a big deal. The previous year, a few members of the Allman Brothers Band sat in during the Dead set in Hartford, and ever since, fans had clamored for an encore. Woodstock was still a not-so-distant fond memory, and enough time had passed since the shit show at Altamont so as not to make too many people nervous about bringing throngs of hippies to a small rural town. Legendary concert promoter Bill Graham was brought in to help with the staging in the backstage area. As co-headliners, the Dead and the Almonds were offered $110,000 each. Ticket prices were set at $10 a pop. Jim and Shelley expected somewhere between 100,000 and 150,000 people to show up, and their estimates were way off. 2 weeks before the show, 100,000 tickets had been sold, and they continued to sell. 3 days before, on Wednesday, 50,000 people had arrived and were already setting up tents on the site. And by that Friday, when the highway was clogged and it looked like Jim and Shelley were up Schitt's Creek, all 150,000 tickets they'd allocated had been sold. But there were currently 200,000 people on site. Those who didn't have tickets were just let in. Jim and Shelley weren't about to let an angry mob tear down $30,000 worth of fencing like they had at Woodstock. They had no choice. When it came to soundcheck, which was scheduled for that day, the bands had no choice but to do it in front of 200,000 people. And he didn't just do a normal soundcheck when that many people were watching. The band, quote-unquote, soundchecked for 40 minutes. The Allman Brothers played for over 90 minutes. And the Grateful Dead, well, they did what the Grateful Dead usually did. Ignored their own business interests in favor of delivering for the faithful. In this instance, that meant two sets, nearly 2 hours. A gesture of goodwill to the thousands who now stood before them. Sugary, Tennessee Jet, Mexicali Blues, Wharf Rat. The Dead soundcheck performance from that Friday at Watkins Glen has since gained legendary status among tape traders. Not only because it was unplanned, but because it included an untitled 18-minute jam that was just as unpredictable as the weekend was turning out to be. Jim Koplik and Shelley Finkel, meanwhile, weren't prepared for unpredictable. And they were quickly finding out that people were nothing if not unpredictable. They kept coming. Hundreds, thousands more. Even though the highway had been shut down, how was it possible? Jim Koplik was asking himself that question when he got a second call from New York State to let him know that the highway had opened back up, which meant that traffic was flowing, and it was headed directly for Watkins Glen. Jim's fears suddenly shifted, from the possibility of having to refund tickets to the inevitability that they hadn't properly planned for that many people. There wouldn't be enough food or water. And as the sun went down that Friday night, they came to the sobering realization that there was only so much they could control. The rest was out of their hands. nothing left to do but wait. Summer Jam at Watkins Glen on Saturday, July 28, 1973, went down in history as the Grateful Dead's biggest show ever, and, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, set a new world record for, quote, the largest audience at a pop festival, unquote. The final head count was somewhere around 600,000 people, four times what was expected. You think Woodstock was a big deal? This was way bigger. Do a Google image search for Watkins Glen 1973 to get a sense of the enormity of the thing. And all things considered, Jim and Shelley got lucky. The same couldn't be said for everyone else. During the band's set late Saturday afternoon, as rain clouds darkened the sky and thunder echoed from out in the distance, four skydivers jumped from a single-engine plane overhead to parachute into the show. They each held an orange flare to light their way as they descended. One of the skydivers, Willard Smith, 35 years old, let his flare get a little too close to his clothes. He burst into flames in the air. He was later found in a nearby wooded area, burned to death. 150 other people were treated at nearby hospitals for injuries, many of which had something to do with the combination of alcohol and either Downs or PCP, the latter of which had been sold as grass to unsuspecting buyers. And then there were others, like Bonnie Bickwick and Mitch Weiser, who were never heard from again. Some got tired of waiting along that broken-down highway that led into Watkins Glen. They turned around and went home. Some drifted along with the exodus that left the raceway at the end of that weekend, headed to other points south, west, and east, like they had never even been there at all. But Bonnie and Mitch were gone. Did they even make it to Summer Jam? Did they ditch on purpose and go somewhere else? Somewhere where the wind don't blow so strange, or did the road have other plans for them? Did they encounter a situation they couldn't get themselves out of? Something an overprotective sister would file under. I told you so. Something unpredictable.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Want to teach your kids financial literacy, but not sure where to start? Greenlight can help. With Greenlight, parents can keep an eye on kids' spending and saving, while kids and teens use a card of their own to build money confidence. As a parent, you can send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and more. It's a convenient way to run your household, customized to your family's needs, and the easy way to raise financially smart kids. Get started with Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
This isn't the first time in the series that we've ran into deadheads attempting to hitchhike and then vanishing. Jennifer Wilmer was said to be hitchhiking to a farm in California. Bonita Bickwit and Mitchell Weiser were standing on the side of the road with a cardboard sign in hopes of attending Summer Jam, the biggest concert since Woodstock. While researching Bridget's case, I found Debbie Hartman, a deputy public administrator out of Santa Cruz, who had her own theory of who is responsible for Bridget's death.
I just think he could be likely. His victims were very similar to Bridget in that they were women on the street, they were in the Cap Street area, they were drug users, they had long brown hair, and they were very vulnerable. What I knew about him or learned about him and his, I think his sister or cousin who had done a kind of extensive story about him online, was that he would kind of start off with women maybe being nice to him and then and moving in and being abusive and trying to kill them. But I think he'd gotten away with things before. I mean, that's just my thought on it, which is why he tried to push this woman in the ocean. And it couldn't have been the first time he would have done that. And when he thought he had killed that woman and rolled her up in a plastic bag and tossed her in the ocean, no one would have found her. But she survived.
Around the same time that Bonita and Mitchell went missing, a serial killer was on the loose in California. The Santa Rosa hitchhiker murders began in February of 1972. Two middle school students, aged 12 and 13, were leaving a skating rink and last seen hitching a ride. Their bodies were stripped naked and thrown down a steep embankment off of the roadway. Their remains were skeletal, and the cause of death could not be determined. A series of similar killings happened from 1972 to 1974, and the FBI issued a report stating that 14 unsolved homicides in this time frame were committed by the same perpetrator. Some believe it was the work of the Zodiac Killer. Some say it was Ted Bundy. But could they have been committed by Jack Boken?
And it just could also be that her remains were never found. If Jack Boken had been successful in pushing Amber M into the ocean and having her sink down, he could have been successful with other people before that. I would love to find out who Amber M is, because if he circled the area where Bridget lived and she was also working the streets and around that area, maybe she knew Bridget. I don't know if Amber M is a pseudonym or if her real name is Amber and her real last name is M, beginning with M or not, but that might be somebody to look for.
Like Ted Bundy, Jack Boken lived two very different lives at the same time. He ran a plumbing business, was married, and had three kids. He was known to be funny, talented at chess, and a very good piano player. But since the age of 10, he had been a sexual predator. His first victim was his three-year-old cousin in 1953. 46 years later, he sat in court with a 21-year-old Cap Street prostitute known only as Amber M. She described to the court how Jack attempted to kill her. On October 4th, Boken pulled up to Cap Street in his white Cadillac and solicited Amber. After being sexually assaulted, Amber suffered two skull fractures from what she believed to be a hammer used on the back of her head. He put her in the trunk, and she played dead as she was wrapped in a plastic garbage bag, which she later bit through in order to breathe. Eventually, Jack pulled over and threw her into a bay. While in the water, Amber managed to get out of the plastic and with incredible strength swam to a dock, then jumped a barbed wire fence and flagged down a motorist.
In 2000, there was applause as Boken was sentenced to 231 years to life in prison for sexually assaulting several sex workers in San Francisco. He was also convicted of trying to murder one of the victims.
It wasn't only Debbie who thought Jack Boken could be responsible for Bridget's murder. While he was in prison, Jackie Horn wrote letters to Jack Boken. She asked him if he knew what happened to Bridget. He denied knowing her and said, "You should have got help for your sister sooner. Heroin is a dead end. So are the Grateful Dead."
He's such a candidate for this type of crime. He's a violent guy. He was a violent guy. And he took a lot of risks. And he had this "I don't really give a damn" type of attitude.
Thanks for checking out Dead and Gone. Dead and Gone is written, hosted, and produced by Payne Lindsay and Jake Brennan. Check out Jake's other music and true crime show, Disgraceland, about musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly, as well as Payne's other shows, Radio Rental, Atlanta Monster, and Up and Vanished. Dead and Gone is a production of Tenderfoot TV and Double Elvis, and brought to you by Cadence 13 and executive produced by Donald Albright, Payne Lindsay, Brady Sadler, and Jake Brennan. The show is produced by myself, Mike Rooney, Alex Vespasted, and Eric Quintana. Mixed by Cooper Skinner. Music by Makeup and Vanity Set, with additional music services by Ryan Spraker. Additional mixing by Matt Bowden. Additional writing by Zeth Lundy. Copy edited by Pat Healy. Research and reporting by Eric Trickey. Cover design by Matt Mills for mattmillsart.com. Special thanks to Oren Rosenbaum and Grace Royer from UTA, Ryan Nord, Jesse Nord, and Matthew Papa from the Nord Group, Chris Cochran and the Cadence 13 team, Beck Media and Marketing, Station 16, and the teams at Tenderfoot TV and Double Elvis. And as always, thank you for your support.
On September 12, 1995, McKay Everett disappeared from his home in Conroe, Texas.
There was no sign of forced entry. It was just as if McKay had walked out of his own free will.
And to this day, McKay's mother, Paulette, feels that justice was never truly served. Ransom is available now. Listen at ransompodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.